side. "Why don't you just come in?" he said, shutting the door after her.
"Go ahead with what you were doing."
She sat down at a table by the window and took a pad and ballpoint from her shirt pocket.
"You have a nice view."
"Look, Miss Sherry..."
"Detective."
"Yes, ma'am. I gotta get back to..."
"I'm here for two reasons, Mr. Purcell. We're looking for a missing kid named Homer Penny. Not missing in the real sense, but missing from the system, if you get my meaning. Someone went into the crime scene where his father was tortured to death and took his clothes from a dresser. Know who might have done that?"
"Someone who knew the kid needed his clothes. Someone who knew the kid would be better off on the moon than in the hands of the people who returned him to his father." Her eyes went to the chair where Cleet had thrown the raincoat. One flap hung over the tip of the baseball bat.
"The second reason I'm here is about Kevin Penny. We found a gold cigarette lighter in the trailer. It belongs to Detective Labiche. But he's got an explanation. He was sent there by Sheriff Swallow to interview Penny."
"That doesn't mean he didn't go there for other reasons."
"You're not a fan?"
"Labiche is a dirty cop."
"How do you know that?"
"I can smell one. He also has a hard-on for Dave Robichaud."
"Thanks for telling me that. Who's Labiche on a pad for?"
"Tony Nineball. Maybe some meth guys in East Texas. Maybe some greaseballs in Tampa or Miami. Take your choice. We're everybody's bunch."
"You know who Maximo Souza and Juju Ladrine are?"
"One's a psychopath. The other has a AAA battery for a brain. They both work for Tony."
"You think they're capable of crucifying a man, drilling his elbows and knees?"
"Maximo would do it in a blink. It's not like Juju."
"What would be the motivation?"
"What motivates these guys to do anything? Half the things they believe don't exist. They're the dumbest shits on earth. That's why they're criminals."
"How about this? Kevin Penny was a federal informant. Maybe Souza and Ladrine were sent to find out if Penny dimed them or Tony Nemo."
"Too extreme, in my opinion."
"So where does that leave us?"
she said, looking straight at him as though she knew the answer to her question. "You got me. I run down bail skips and do other kinds of scut work for Nig Rosewater and Wee Willie Bimstein."
"How about the fact that they were following you around? They even parked their vehicle by the house of your lady friend while you were doing a sleepover."
"How about leaving third parties out of this?" he said.
"Then you had a confrontation with them in downtown Jennings. Then your lady friend got beaten to a pulp. The word is you have some bad markers out. You also gave Kevin Penny a bad time about his kid. Maybe you figured all three of them for the beating of the Ardwin woman, and you started with Penny."
Cleet halved the loaf of French bread into two long buns and began layering them with lettuce and sliced tomatoes and chopped onions and deep-fried crawfish and oysters he had taken from the icebox. "Short answer, Detective, I never put a hand on Penny."
"We lifted a lot of prints from the trailer. Most of them were in the computer at the NCIC. Some were not. That bothers me."
"Because people like Penny don't have normal friends?"
"But yours were all over the place. I've seen your sheet. I've known recidivists who would be in awe of your record."
He released the handle of the knife and stared straight ahead. "I'll try again. I was in the crotch. I did two tours in Vietnam. I saw guys who were skinned alive and hung in trees. I don't torture people." He picked up a small clean brush and began painting mayonnaise and shrimp dip on his sandwich.
"My husband was killed in Iraq," she said.
He turned around. Her face was calm, her eyes clear. She seemed to be looking at a thought or memory inside her head. "I'm sorry," he said.
"You have to get on the square about the missing boy, Mr. Purcell."
"I am on the square. Nothing bad is ever going to happen to that little boy again."
"You committed a felony by deliberately violating a crime scene and taking items from it. You know that, don't you?"
He put the sandwich together and cut it in half. "I'll split this with you."
She got up and walked to the chair where the raincoat was. She tugged it slightly so it covered the bottom of the bat.
No thanks.
He wiped his hands on a dish towel and watched her. She wore her gun and badge and cuffs on her belt, perhaps as a statement of her own identity and in defiance of male authority. She wasn't aggressive, but she wasn't passive either. She seemed to live inside a place beyond the fray. She straightened her shoulders and looked out the window at the live oaks arching over the driveway. She turned around as though asking him, "Why the silence?"
"There's a snitch in Lafayette named Pookie Domang," Cleet said. "Sometimes people call him Pookie the Possum. He says the word is out, you'd better get your head on straight."
"Or?"
"There are 8 dead women who want justice. Somebody out there doesn't want that to happen, Miss Sherry."
"Detective Picard," she said.
"Yes, ma'am. Forget I said anything. I think I really screwed up in a previous incarnation."
Cleet sat down at the table and bit into his sandwich. Then she was standing behind him.
"I'm going to cover your ass as best I can. Take care of Homer and Ms. Ardoin. If you shot me a line on any of this, I'll be back."
She dragged a fingernail across the back of his neck as she went out the door. He set down his food and went out on the stoop. He was going to tell her something. He was sure of that. He just didn't know what it was. That afternoon, Helen and I met with the prosecutor, Lala Segretti. He was tall and in his mid-50s and had freckles and thinning light red hair and wore suspenders and always looked wired. When he was a long-distance runner at LSU and a pretty girl would walk by, he would say, "Ooh la la," to hide that he was afraid of girls because he'd grown up in a fundamentalist church Ayatollah Khomeini could have invented. He was a family man and a straight shooter, but he obsessed over things of no consequence and sometimes translated the Old Testament into a political mindset that precluded compassion, particularly when it came to capital punishment. We were in the conference room at a long oak table with him at the head of it, pages from my report spaced out in front of him. He was blinking, his jaw tight. He was obviously agitated, but I didn't know about what. He was one of those men who could eat any kind of food without gaining weight, as though a flame in his stomach burned off the intake the second it came down the pipe.
"Everything all right, sir?" I said.
"We've got a shitstorm coming down on us because of the Nightingale indictment," he said. "Plus a lot of criticism about an in-house matter." He looked at me to make sure I got the point. "I'm the in-house matter," I said.
"We'll talk about that later," he replied.
I felt a constriction behind my left eye that caused my eye to water and sent a signal to my brain that has always scared me and that I have never understood.
"Nightingale's constituency thinks we're political," Lala said. "The problem is, to some degree, they're right. He's a demagogue and a liar, and I want to put him out of business before he turns the state into a sewer. We can't let them get away with it."
"Who's they?" Helen said. "Get away with what?"
"His hacks and hucksters. He has an army of them. He's got backers in Vegas. I think they're grooming him for bigger things."
"I don't think this conversation is taking a good turn," I said.
Lala looked at me again. "Rephrase that so I don't get the wrong inference."
"Nightingale is guilty of sexual assault and battery, or he isn't," I said.
"Dave's right," Helen said. "We do our job and stay out of the consequences."
"I don't think I've expressed myself very well," he said. "Nightingale and his family are associated with criminals. They've gotten a free pass for years. Iberia Parish voted down casino gambling. That will always be to our credit.
We're not going to allow this son of a bitch to besmirch us."
"You're not alone in your feelings," Helen said. Lala wasn't listening. His attention was fixed on me.
"In your report, I get a sense of hesitancy," he said.
"Some elements in the case that aren't clear," I said. "Why would Rowena delay reporting the rape? Why does she destroy evidence? She's educated and intelligent, so is her husband."
"Traumatized people don't behave rationally," he said.
"The family physician indicates she may have been a neglected wife," I said.
"Neglected wives have drinks with another man or even affairs, but that doesn't mean they invite rape into their lives," he said.
I'm with you on that. The room was silent. Helen cleared her throat. A tree limb brushed against the window.
What are you holding back?
He asked me. The last time I talked to Levon, he didn't mention Nightingale not being in jail. That was the kind of thing I expected him to say. It was almost like he didn't care.
That's perception, not evidence, he said.
How many sexual assault cases are not about perception, I said.
Levon Broussard spat in Nightingale's face at Iberia General. Doesn't that tell you something?
That was then. This is now.
You're muddy in the water, Dave, he said. I don't understand why. Helen, could I speak to Dave alone, please?
Powder my nose, she said.
I didn't mean it that way.
Your ass, she said, and left the room. Score one for Helen Swallow. After she was gone, Lala put the pages of my report back into a folder and leaned forward, his face bladed with color, his nose cut out of tin. The investigation into the D'Arthez homicide has been the most unusual in my career.
Really?
I said.
Don't be clever with me, Dave. There's a cloud over your head, and nothing we do seems to get rid of it. The department and my office have been taking your weight.
Then stop doing it.
It's not a time to be gallant. LaBiche lifted your prints on the broken glass from the driver's side of the truck. That detail will not go away, unless you're willing to make it go away.
What are you hinting at?
You were at the D'Arthez house and could have touched his truck. Or maybe on another occasion.
He paused, then said,
Am I right?
I could have.
You did, or you didn't?
I could hear a motorboat on the bayou. I wanted to get up and walk to the window and float away. Above the picnic shelters and trees and children playing on swing sets and seesaws. I did not touch D'Arthez's vehicle at his home. I cannot explain the presence of my fingerprints on the glass. I could hear myself breathing in the silence. I counted the seconds. I got up to 14, then restarted the count, my heart twisting.
You think you did it?
He asked.
Just say it. Let's end this crap.
I think I'm capable of it.
You truly mean that? You would kill a man with your bare hands?
Yes, sir.
Are you done with your drinking?
I could feel my control slipping. My old enemy, childhood rage, surfacing once again. It's not my drinking, I began. I saw a red glow behind my eyes and heard a popping sound in my ears. I started over. No, sir, I cannot swear that I'm done. No drunk can. He leaned back in his chair. He shook his head as though in bewilderment.
Best of everything to you.
Want to translate that?
You're an honorable man, but others have to pay your tab.
I have to say the cut went deep.
Anything else?
He didn't answer. When I opened the door to leave, he was standing at the window, a hand on his hip, staring at the park, his shirt pinched inside his suspenders. I never popped a cap on somebody who didn't ask for it, I said. Even in a free fire zone.
Hoorah,
he said without turning around. Chapter 22. At one time, St. Mary Parish was a fiefdom ruled by an oligarchical family who owned everything and everyone in the parish, bar none. In the 1970s, when a group of activist Catholic nuns tried to organize the cane workers, they found themselves at mortal risk in an area that was more than 90% Catholic. Enforcement of the law was situational. Every public servant knew which ring to kiss. The people at the bottom of the pile were not necessarily abused, but they weren't necessarily protected from abuse either. Sexual exploitation is not a subject most police departments like to deal with, but it's often there. A cop picks up a hippie runaway hitchhiking. Maybe she's holding, maybe she's got a warrant on her, maybe she's 16 and her teeth are chattering. It's twilight. She's in the back seat, wrists cuffed behind her, trying to see where they're going as the cop swings around on the shoulder and
heads down a two-lane away from town. The cop has already dropped his badge inside his pocket so she won't get his number. His name was Jude McVane. Before he was a deputy sheriff, he was a chaser in a Navy brig, a hack in a woman's prison, and a collector for a loan company. He had big hands and smelled of manly odors and was good at his paperwork because he did as little of it as possible. There were never any complaints about him, but his colleagues did not hang out with him after work hours, particularly those who were protective of their wives' sensibilities. At sunrise Thursday, he was driving his cruiser on a two-lane back road that followed the curves along Bayou Teche. The primroses were blooming on the edge of the cane fields, the sun spangling inside the tunnel of live oaks. He passed two antebellum homes built in the early 19th century, then crossed a drawbridge and turned into a trailer village that belonged in Bangladesh. He stopped in front of a trailer occupied by a young black single mother. Without speaking, she exited the trailer, locked the door behind her, and got into the back of the cruiser. "Good morning, sunshine," McVane said. She looked wanly out the window. He drove out of the trailer park and back across the drawbridge and past a closed sugar refinery. Then he hooked back into the confines of the refinery on a dirt road and parked in the shade of a rusted-out tin shed. "Nobody does it like you," he said, getting him back. When she was finished, she walked away from the cruiser and cleared her mouth and spat. "I always heard it taste like watermelon rind," he said. She refused to speak. He drove her back to her home and watched her get out and go inside. He shifted into gear and drove out of the trailer park and back over the Teche and headed toward Franklin. A solitary figure was walking around the edge of the road, dragging a wheeled case behind him, a beach bag hanging from his shoulder. McVane pulled alongside and rolled down the passenger window. "Where you going, partner?" The man wore red tennis shoes and khakis that probably came from Target, and a green T-shirt with Bugs Bunny eating a carrot on the front.
"I'm touring the country, Five. I got off the bus at the Wong place."
"Where are you from?"
"New Orleans, originally. My name is Chester. Sometimes people call me Smiley."
"Chester what?"
"Wimple. What's yours?"
"Get in."
"Why?"
"I'll take you where you're going."
Chester leaned his head in the window and sniffed.
"There's been a woman in here."
"Get in the cruiser, please."
"I like walking."
"I guess it's going to be one of those days," McVane said.
"All right. If you want to act like that, I don't want to make anybody mad."
The man got inside and inhaled.
"Icky."
"What is?"
"Like somebody has been doing something he shouldn't."
"Buckle up," McVane said.
He drove down the road until he reached an oak grove. He turned inside it and cut the engine.
"I have a feeling you got loose from an institution, Chester."
"I did no such thing."
"Let's see your identification."
"No."
"I'm sorry?"
"You're being impolite and talking to me in a hurtful way."
"I think you're from Crazy Town, Chester."
"Crazy Town people have to be housed and fed and medicated. They also create shit piles of paperwork. Now get rid of the baby talk and show me your fucking ID."
"I knew people like you in the orphanage. They were bullies and loudmouths and had no manners."
"You're really starting to piss me off. Smart mouth me again and I'll slap you upside the head, boy."
"I'm going to walk. You need to clean out this car. You should be ashamed of yourself."
"That's it, you little geek. You're under arrest."
"For what?"
"Deliberately creating a dangerous situation on a state highway."
"That's silly."
McVane got out and came around the front of the cruiser and ripped open the passenger door. Chester was putting on a pair of cotton gloves. What are you doing with those gloves? McVane said.
I don't want to touch anything in your nasty car.
McVane reached for him. Then for the first time, he saw the absence of light in Chester's eyes. He'd seen it before. Once in a lockdown unit at Miramar in the eyes of a female prisoner who had murdered her children. And once in the eyes of a woman he'd sodomized in the back of a liquor store. The revolver was a .357 Magnum. The bullets in the cylinder fat and round and hollow-pointed. The words he wanted to say were trapped inside a gaseous and foul bubble in his throat. The release of his sphincter like wet newspaper tearing apart. His fear so intense, he pulled his weapon crookedly from the holster and fumbled it onto the grass. He tried to smile at his ineptitude, giving up all pretense at manliness, hoping for mercy. The slug hit him in the upper lip like a sledgehammer, and the back of his skull exploded in a gush of bone and brain matter, similar to a grapefruit bursting. Chester walked round to the driver's side and picked up McVane's hat from the dashboard and put it on, then straightened it in the side mirror. The engine was still running. He climbed in and drove away, remembering the 10-2 position on the steering wheel that he had learned in driving school. My, what a fine morning it was. He hit the whoop-whoop button a couple of times and wondered if he shouldn't apply for the police force somewhere. He'd probably be pretty good at it, he thought. It was time someone did something about the number of criminals and no goods overrunning the countryside. The body was located right by the St. Mary Iberia parish line. The cruiser had been driven through New Iberia, past City Hall and my house out to Spanish Lake, and left half submerged in the water. The wind was blowing at 30 knots. No fishermen were on the lake. A black kid who worked in the bait shop said he'd seen the cruiser drive on top of the levee to the north end of the lake, but he'd paid little attention because sometimes policemen stopped at the lake to eat lunch or take a smoke. He said he'd seen a man walking past the bait shop a half hour later. The man was pulling a small suitcase, but he didn't remember what the man looked like. Helen and I watched the wrecker pull the cruiser from the cattails, the doors gushing water and mud. We had already been to the crime scene on the parish line, but we had gone in separate vehicles and had talked little among ourselves.
Somebody shoots a deputy, steals the cruiser, drives through town and dumps it in a lake in broad daylight, she said.
We get them all, don't we? I walked down the embankment and looked through the driver's window. A deputy sheriff's hat was floating on the floor. The cut-down 12-gauge pump was still locked in place on the dash.
You ever meet this guy?
McVane, she said.
Yeah, you ever meet him? No. What's the story? She said.
He had a bad rep with his colleagues.
For what?
Black women didn't always go to jail.
You think it was one of them?
She asked. How many poor black women carry a firearm that can blow a hole the size of a tangerine in a guy's head? Also, he was shot at close range outside the cruiser. There were no other car tracks in the Oak Grove. Either he met somebody who was on foot, or the person was in his cruiser, and the two of them got out and the shooter made his move.
Our guy didn't see it coming, either, she said.
Probably not.
It's your baby, Streak.
I've got enough on my desk, Helen.
Sorry, Pops.
I don't get along well with the guys in St. Mary Parish.
Boo-hoo, she replied.
She got into her vehicle and drove away. I returned to the crime scene on the parish line. Everyone was gone. I stepped inside the tape. The wind was still up, bending the grass inside the grove, some of it stiff with blood. The spray pattern of the wound pointed toward the bayou. I stood next to the place the body had been and pressed my hands together and formed a V, like the needle on a compass. Then I aimed between my thumbs as though through iron sights, trying to see where the bullet could have gone. The trees were widely spaced, which was not helpful. I tried to see the shooter inside my head. Nobody likes cop killers, even when they kill a guy like McVane. Most of them go out smoking. Usually they're almost hysterical with fear and get as stoned and drunk as they can before they check out. Sometimes they take their families with them.
A cop killer on the loose is like a tiger prowling a schoolyard. You're going to hear a lot from him until someone pulls his plug. The size and character of the entrance and exit wounds indicated the bullet was of large caliber and fired from a serious gun. The round was probably a hollow point or a dum-dum or a soft nose that had been notched. The shooter was probably a man, big enough to carry the weapon on his person without McVane noticing it. But why did McVane pull into the Grove? The St. Mary cop said he didn't smoke. The Grove was too visible for a tryst or even for harmless goofing off on the job. Maybe he was doing his paperwork when a hitchhiker walked up on him. But why would an armed hitchhiker walk up on a cop he didn't know and shoot him in cold blood? Maybe the shooter was a fugitive. Maybe he did something suspicious on the road and McVane questioned him. But McVane didn't call in the encounter, and he hadn't been alarmed to the point of drawing his weapon, at least not until it was too late. I looked at the serenity inside the Grove, the wind scudding on the bayou, the moss straightening in the trees. It was the kind of spot you associate with rest, peace of mind, withdrawal from the fray. It was an unlikely place for a violent confrontation, a disruption caused by two disparate personalities trying to kill each other, one succeeding. Why was McVane late in pulling his gun? He was outside the cruiser, at some point obviously aware that he was in mortal danger. Why did he let his defenses down? This wasn't consistent with the image of a cop who, according to his colleagues, cut suspects no slack and cuffed and searched them roughly and hooked them to a D-ring on the cruiser's floor. I didn't believe the shooter was local. Aside from two antebellum homes, there were only a few trailers and abandoned shacks spaced along the two-lane, and they were not occupied by the kind of people who would chat up a cop like McVane. It had to be a hitchhiker. Did McVane pick him up? An armed and dangerous man? No, he must have known and trusted the shooter. But where did the gun come from? The weather was warm. A hiker on the road wouldn't have been wearing a coat. Perhaps he was carrying a bag or a backpack. He was probably white. Someone so innocuous in appearance that McVane had no fear of him. Someone he held in contempt. What kind of person would that be? I began to see an image of the stroller hitchhiker, a seemingly harmless character made of Play-Doh, one with a soft mouth and girlish hips and buttocks that waddled, the perfect target for a virile and strong and sadistic male. Back to weaponry and ballistics. No shell casing had been found. Unless the shooter picked up his brass, the weapon was a revolver. The fatal round had exited the back of McVane's head and had to be somewhere. It was not inside the blood and brain matter on the grass, which meant it may not have fragmented. I went from tree trunk to tree trunk, running my hands over the bark. I looked down the slope. The Teche was a tidal stream that swelled up on the banks each day and receded with the influences of the moon. The surface was yellow and swollen and churning with mud and leaves and tree branches scattered by the same high winds that had swept through the area earlier in the day. A rowboat was tied to a cypress root a few feet down the bank. On the far side of the bayou was a weathered boathouse with a sagging dock. I got into the boat and rowed across. Sometimes you get lucky. A bullet was lodged in the door. I opened my pocket knife and eased it out of the wood. The nose was flattened. The sides morphed out of shape like a piece of bent licorice. The striations were intact. I wrapped the bullet in a handkerchief and wadded up the handkerchief and put it into my pocket, then rowed back across the bayou. I called Helen and told her what I'd found. "Take it to the lab," she said. "Want me to check in with the locals?" "In St. Mary Parish," she said. "I may make a stop before I head back." "Stop where?" "Maybe the shooter was on an errand and McVane messed up his plan." "I'm not following you." "Jimmy Nightingale's place is just down the road. Maybe he was a target."
Why? Jimmy's predecessors are Huey Long and George Wallace. I think he'll come to the same end.
It's your case. Talk to you later, she said.
Even after Jimmy had told me about the bombing of the Indian village, I did not want to believe he was an evil man. Even though I had concluded in my report that he'd attacked Rowena Broussard, I believed his mind had been addled by booze and hash and driven more by desire than by sadistic intent. Why did I not want to believe these things? Like most of us who subscribe to the egalitarian traditions of Jefferson and Lincoln, I did not want to believe that a basically likable man could, with indifference and without provocation, commit deeds that were not only wicked, but destroyed the lives of defenseless people. I also reminded myself that Jimmy was haunted by guilt, which is not the trademark of the unredeemable. As I pulled up to the Nightingale Mansion on the bayou, I did not realize I was about to see a drama that could have come from the stage of the Globe Theater on the banks of the Thames. I heard shouting on the patio, and walked around the side of the house and saw Bobby Earle and Emmeline Nightingale 4 feet apart, red-faced and hurling invective at each other. Down the slope, Jimmy was calmly whacking golf balls high into the sky, watching them drop into the bayou. His chauffeur, the peroxided one with the steroid-puffed physique and caved-in face, stood by his side, waiting to put a fresh tee and ball on the grass. None of them saw me. Earl's face was trembling.
He denounced me on national television. Do you know what this has done to me? I went to prison for our cause.
You went to prison for tax evasion, Emmeline said.
I gave him my constituency.
You don't have one. Now get off our property.
You're a poisonous creature, Emmeline. The great whore of Babylon in the making.
And you're a self-important public fool. Good God, I don't know how Jimmy stands you.
Hello, I said.
They both looked at me as though awakening from a dream.
What do you want, Mr. Robichaud? Emmeline asked.
A word with you and Jimmy, I said. Bobby doesn't need to hang around.
Earl's face was full of hurt like a child's. This was the same man who had inflamed the passions of the great unwashed, then disavowed their actions when they burned and bombed and lynched. But I realized that, instead of the devil, I was looking at a moth batting its wings around a light that had grown cold. He had a pot stomach, like a balloon filled with water. His face was lined, his eyes tired. There was a pout on his mouth.
You remember that time you hit me?
I do, I replied.
It was a sucker punch. I had no chance to defend myself.
You asked for it, and you were looking me straight in the face. His eyes were wet.
The Nightingales wouldn't let you clean their bathroom, Dave.
You're probably right, I said, and don't call me Dave. Jimmy walked up the slope, his golf club propped on his shoulder.
I must have missed out on quite a discussion.
I told Bobby to leave, Emmeline said.
Better do as she says, Bobby, Jimmy said. She's tough.
You've betrayed me, Earl said.
Two paths diverged in the woods, Jimmy said. You should have followed mine, not yours.
A pox on both y'all, Earl said.
Work on your accent, Emmeline said. Everyone knows you're from Kansas.
Earl's face seemed to dissolve. He walked away trying to hold himself erect. When he got into his car, he looked back at the patio. By then, Emmeline was removing a pitcher of iced tea and the glasses from the table, and Jimmy was wiping off the mahogany head of his club with a rag. I had the feeling that if there is an invisible hell people carry with them, Earl had found it.
What put you at our door, Dave? Jimmy said.
A cop was shot and killed not far from your home. We don't know why, nor do we have anything on the shooter.
And?
You're a famous man, I said.
I heard the cop didn't have a big fan club.
The people he abused are not the kind who smoke cops.
I don't think this fellow's demise has anything to do with me. Want to hit some balls?
Listen to him, Jimmy. Emmeline said.
This is how I feel about death, he said. I've had a good life. If a stranger walks up to me and parks one in my brain, I'll thank him for waiting as long as he did.
The cop's name was McVane, I said. Did you know him?
No. Why do you ask?
I thought maybe he took a bullet for you. But who knows? Maybe the guy was trafficking. Or maybe an ex-lover got him. You never know.
There are people out there who won't hurt Jimmy, but not because he's running for office, Emmeline said. That gangster in New Orleans is actually putting together an adaptation of Levon Broussard's work.
Tony Nemo?
Yes, the same obscene pile you people could never put in jail, she said. Jimmy had everything ready to go. Then you went along with Rowena Broussard's lies and destroyed Jimmy's chances of producing the film. When this is over, I'm going to personally sue you into oblivion.
Thank you for telling me that, I said. Unfortunately, I'm mortgaged up to my eyes and not worth suing. I saw Jimmy laugh silently behind her back.
What, you think that's funny? She said to me.
No, I said, barely able to stifle a grin. I hated to admit Jimmy Nightingale still had a hold on me. I guess that's just the way it was, growing up in a place like Louisiana, where pagan deities sometimes hide among us and we secretly champion rogues who get even for the rest of us. The round was a .357 Magnum. We got a priority in processing at the National Crime Information Center because the round had been recovered from a homicide scene. The weapon that had probably killed McVane was an electronic match with six other bullets fired from the same weapon over a 7-year period, most recently in Algiers, where two black men were shot to death in the kitchen of a rented house full of crack paraphernalia. I spent the next 3 days talking to cops in Orleans Parish, Tampa, Key West, Fort Lauderdale, and New York. Other than the two crack dealers, the victims were a retired button man from Yonkers, a bartender who shilled for a craps game, a serial pedophile, and a Shylock. The obvious common denominator in the victims was criminality. But if these were mob-connected hits, the usual pattern wasn't there. Button men, so known because they pushed the off button on their victims, didn't use the same weapon repeatedly. They also favored a smaller caliber handgun because the bullet slowed more quickly and bounced around inside the brain pan. Their classic execution featured one round through the forehead, one in the mouth, and one in the ear. Our shooter seemed spontaneous and left wounds all over the map. He had a way of painting the walls in public, too, without anyone ever getting a good description of him. For example, he walked into a clam house in Brooklyn and fired point-blank into the face of an infamous gangster who was having a midnight dinner with a beloved television actor. The shooter was so nondescript that no one could remember a distinguishing detail about him. One diner said the man picked up a raw oyster on the way out and sucked it from the shell and apologized to the diner for disturbing his meal. I went into Helen's office and told her everything I had.
This sounds like either an East Coast hitter or a maniac, she said.
Or both.
What's he doing here? She said.
At least we know it probably wasn't about McVane, but that means the real target is still out there.
Nightingale?
That would be my bet.
You said Nightingale blew you off.
His sister didn't. She thinks Tony Nemo wants to take Jimmy off the board because Jimmy wants to produce Levon Broussard's work.
No wonder most films hurt my eyeballs, she said. She spun her ballpoint on her desk bed.
Something else bothering you?
The prosecutor's office. Lala Segretti thinks you should retire.
She kept her gaze straight ahead, not looking at me.
He says the D'Artes homicide and investigation will always be a subject of scandal.
What's your opinion?
If you go, I go too.
Nobody got me drunk except me.
The DA has got his head up his ass on this one, she said.
You're a loyal friend, Helen. She massaged the back of her neck with both hands, her breasts swelling against her shirt.
And shit goes great with vanilla ice cream.
I didn't try to think through that last one.
Chapter 23. I looked at the array of notes, file, folders, and photos on my desk. I had cases that had been open 15 years. Most of them would never be solved. I knew inmates who were innocent of the crimes they were in for, but guilty of far more serious ones, including homicides. I knew scores of politicians who sold out their constituencies on a daily basis and were lauded for it. Every cop has a private ulcer about a particular child molester who skates, a victim of sexual assault who's hung out to dry by a misogynistic judge, a greaseball who plays the role of a family man while he extorts and ruins small businessmen, or a racist cop whose behavior puts shooters on rooftops. How do you handle it when your anger brims over the edge of the pot? You use the shortened version of the Serenity Prayer, which is, fuck it. Like Voltaire's Candide tending his own garden, or the British infantry going up the Khyber Pass one bloody foot at a time, you do your job and you grin and walk through the cannon smoke and you just keep saying, fuck it. You also have faith in your own convictions and never let the naysayers and those who are masters at inculcating self-doubt hold sway in your life. Fuck it is not profanity. Fuck it is a sonnet. In this instance, that meant I had to trust my own perceptions about several open cases I believed were connected. At the bottom of the pyramid were the Jeff Davis 8. The cultural background was prostitution and narcotics and white slavery. Kevin Penny was a player. He had ties with the Nightingale family, of what kind I wasn't sure. A witness put Penny at the site of the D'Arthez murder. Why was he there? Had he been sent to follow me and do me harm? Probably, although I had gone to his trailer later and he'd seemed unsure of my identity, which meant he had never gotten a good look at me the night D'Arthez was killed. Then there was Spade Labiche. Labiche had been seen with Penny right before the D'Arthez killing. His prints were also in Penny's trailer, though he claimed he had been there to interview Penny and for no other reason. In the mix were Tony Nineball, Jimmy and Emmeline Nightingale, and Levon and Rowena, Broussard, and finally the attack upon Rowena by Jimmy. Strangely enough, I believe the key lay in the tortured death of Penny and the rape of Rowena. The question marks in both cases seemed endless. Who would put Penny through such an ordeal? My guess was Tony Nineball. Sherry Picard had said Penny was a federal informant. In his younger years, Tony's logo was a bloody baseball bat. But Tony's victims were either left alive or disappeared altogether. They weren't left at a crime scene with toggle bolts drilled through their limbs. Another issue was Levon's apparent lack of interest in prosecuting Jimmy Nightingale, the same man whose face he'd spat into. Levon was the kind of idealist you admired but also feared. He seemed to have the inclinations of a pacifist, but owned a large number of firearms. He despised dictators and demagogues, but revered his ancestors in gray who were authoritarian in their own fashion. He had been a leftist in Latin America, then traveled to Cuba and been picked up by the secret police and confined for a month in a hellish place filled with cockroaches and lice and feces. In my opinion, Levon and Jimmy Nightingale were opposite sides of the same coin. Neither understood himself, and without knowing it, both of them probably served an agenda created for them by someone else, perhaps long dead. From a professional perspective, my investigation into the rape of Rowena Broussard was over, but I couldn't let it go. Something was wrong. Why the continued coldness or hostility from both her and her husband? Wouldn't they conclude that the wheels of justice were going forward? Jimmy had been charged and indicted and held up in the public eye as a rapist. Maybe his political career would be destroyed. Rowena would probably be a devastating witness at the trial. What more did they want? I drove to their house on Lauraville Road. Levon and his wife were eating at a dining table in their screened-in, brick-floored back porch. Even though we were in the midst of spring, the evening sky was lit incongruously with the colors of a Halloween pumpkin. Rowena's wrists were still bandaged. Levon wore a sports shirt and slacks and Roman sandals without socks.
He didn't stand up to shake hands when I opened the screen door. For a man of his background, that message was as blunt as it got. "Sorry I didn't call in advance," I said.
"What do you need, Dave?"
"You heard about the shooting of the cop in St. Mary?"
"On the roadside? Something like that?"
"It happened not far from Jimmy Nightingale's place," I said. "We are eating," Rowena said.
"I noticed," I replied. Levon's eyes lifted to mine.
"Say what's on your mind."
"Long ago I learned that hostility and fear are first cousins," I said.
"Big breakthrough?" he said.
"It beats cancer and heart disease."
"Let me make it easy for you," he said. "You feel we're ungrateful. We're not. But we're not happy, either. You're too close to Nightingale. You did your job, but you did it grudgingly."
"You're wrong." I waited for his reply. Or rather, I hoped he might act like the genteel man he was and ask me to sit down. I didn't mention that hostility was also a first cousin of guilt. Again, I noticed the leanness in his face, the pinched light in his eyes, as though an illness were taking over his body. Then I said what had probably been in my subconscious for a long time. "You saw the dark side in Latin America?"
"So?"
"The use of electrodes. People hung by their wrists with a sack of insecticide pulled over their heads."
"Worse than that," he said. "How far would you be willing to go yourself?"
He set down his knife and fork and stared at the two candles burning on the table.
"I don't think I heard you right."
"Maybe you went looking for evidence on your own. Maybe you used a PI to check out Nightingale's employees and came up with Kevin Penny's name. Maybe you thought he was a guy who'd have some useful information."
"I tortured somebody to death?" he said.
"It's the stuff of the Inquisition."
"I can't take any more of this," Rowena said.
She left the table and went through the kitchen door into the house. I leaned over the table as though to speak to him and let my hand tip his wine glass. It rolled off the table and shattered on the brick. "I'm sorry."
"You can say that again," he said.
He got up, wiping his trousers, then went in the house for a broom and dustpan. I used my handkerchief to pick up his butter knife and drop it into my pocket. He came back outside.
"You're still here."
"I always respected you and your wife, Levon. Don't pretend I didn't."
"You pretend about everything, Dave. Jimmy Nightingale has all the trappings of a fascist. Tell me that's not so."
"He shit-canned Bobby Earle."
"That's because he doesn't need him anymore," he said. "Why don't you genuflect before him while you're at it?"
"See you around," I said.
"Not if I have anything to do with it," he replied.
I went to the lab early Tuesday morning. They lifted Levon's prints off the knife, and I took them on a card to Jennings and left them with the desk sergeant for Sherry Picard. She called me the next day. I had not given her any directions or information about the source of the latents on the knife, maybe in part because I didn't want to confirm my own suspicions.
"They're a match," she said.
"With what?"
"The latents in Penny's trailer. That's why you sent them, right?"
"Correct."
"Whose are they?" she asked.
"Levon Broussard's."
"The author?" she said.
"Yep."
"They were on two doorknobs. They were also on the drill."
My heart was in my throat. "Were there any others on the drill?"
"Just his."
"I guess you guys better get a warrant." I don't believe I ever spoke sadder words. The next day, Labiche was not only in my office, he was hooking one haunch on the corner of my desk, flipping a half dollar and catching it. "Good detective work, Groby."
"Which detective work?"
"Bringing down that snooty ass wipe on Lowellville Road."
"Levon Broussard?"
"Him and his wife both think this shit doesn't stink."
"What did you hear?"
"He's in custody. He'll probably bail out this afternoon. From what I understand, you nail his dick to his forehead. I guess this might screw up his wife's rape claim, too."
"What does one have to do with the other?"
"Everything."
Labiche was right. I just didn't want to admit it. How well did you know Kevin Penny, Spade?
Me?
Just from the interview? Why would I know him otherwise?
You worked Vice in Miami. Penny was an active guy, thereabouts.
Where do you come up with these scenarios?
I think you're a dirty cop, I said. He stood up, his face constricting.
I gave you a way out of the Dantes beef. I covered for your drunk ass, because I've had problems of my own.
Good show. No cigar.
Yeah?
He blew air out his nose and smiled. He caught the half dollar and put it away.
You couldn't carry my jockstrap, Robo.
Labiche was wrong about LeVon making bail that afternoon. Unlike his counterpart Jimmy Nightingale, LeVon didn't make friends with authorities or politicians he didn't like. The South has changed in many ways, but beyond the sophistry and hush-puppy platitudes is a core group that is as malignant and hot and sweaty as a torch-lit mob flinging a rope over a tree limb. The judge before whom LeVon appeared was the Honorable Bienville Tomé. His face had the choleric intensity of a dried squash and the same level of humanity. He wore his irritability like a flag.
What the hell do you have to say for yourself?
He asked LeVon.
Nothing, Your Honor, LeVon answered.
You enter a plea of not guilty?
Yes, that's correct, Your Honor, LeVon's attorney said.
I didn't ask you. The defendant will answer my question.
Yes, sir, LeVon said.
Yes, sir, what?
LeVon looked out the window and didn't reply.
Are you deaf?
I don't have anything to say, sir.
You mean Your Honor?
LeVon continued to stare out the window.
I didn't torture or kill anyone. Interpret that in any way you wish.
Remanded in custody,
the judge said. He snapped down his gavel as he would a fly swatter. I was allowed to see LeVon in a holding cell. It was an old one with a concrete floor that sloped down to a drain hole with a yellow-streaked perforated iron lid. There was no bench or chair to sit on. He stood at the door in an orange jumpsuit, his hands on the bars.
Why were you in Penny's trailer? I said.
Rowena remembered something. Actually, it was in a dream. In her dream, the assault by the two black guys was mixed up with the assault on Nightingale's boat. And then she heard a voice. It was a man with his mouth right by her ear. The pillowcase was over her head, so she couldn't see his face. She thought it was one of the black guys. It wasn't. The voice said, "Here's a penny for your thoughts." The voice wasn't Nightingale's, either.
"Go on," I said. "When you question a suspect, you do not offer any information unless you want him to think you know more than you do. In this instance, I wanted LeVon to give up details that only a perpetrator would know. Unbeknownst to him, he might also give up details that could set him free."
When Rowena told me about the dream, I began to think maybe Nightingale wasn't her attacker, or maybe there was more than one attacker, somebody who held her down. I know a guy who used to work for Nightingale. He gave me the names of almost everybody on his payroll. That's how I made the connection between Kevin Penny and Rowena's dream.
Go on.
I went to see him. Nobody answered. The door was unlocked. I opened it and went inside. That's when I heard him.
Heard him?
He was alive, moaning. His wrists were bolted to the floor, above his head, like the hanged man in the tarot deck.
What did he say?
He didn't say anything. He was choking on his vomit. The drill was hanging out of his ear. I removed it and turned his cheek to let his mouth drain. Then he died.
What did you do next?
I left.
Why didn't you call 911? He brushed at his nose.
I don't know.
Your lawyer will tell you that "I don't know" is not the way to win people's hearts and minds.
I told myself Penny had it coming. There wasn't any point in my getting involved.
You left your prints at the scene. Wouldn't it be better to explain your presence there than to flee?
I wasn't thinking, Dave. His eyes were rolled in his head. His face was contorted in a death mask. It was horrible.
You saw the work of the death squads in El Salvador and Guatemala. I don't think you rattled that easily. His hands were high on the bars, his head down.
It wasn't my best day.
You had doubts about Jimmy Nightingale's guilt? His gaze remained on the floor. His hair was uncut, hanging in his eyes. That's it, isn't it? I said. You didn't want to let Nightingale off the hook?
He took her to the boat. He got her drunk. He was doing everything he could to get in her pants.
That doesn't make him a rapist.
If Nightingale didn't rape her, he knew Penny did.
Not if Nightingale was passed out.
Why not join his defense team?
I don't have to be here, I said. Somebody slammed a gate. Somebody else dragged a baton across a row of bars. Another someone was yelling gibberish from a cell. Think hell is just in the next world? Visit your average county bag or rental prison.
I've written about the Jeff Davis Eight, Levon said. Look in on Rowena, will you?
Sure.
Tell Nightingale this doesn't change anything. He's a liar and a fraud, and I'm going to prove it to the world. I hate that son of a bitch.
On Friday night, Crete took Homer to a movie in New Iberia, then for ice cream. Homer carried the baseball glove Crete gave him on his belt and never took off his baseball cap. On the way home, his face looked wizened in the dashlight, as though it had been freeze-burned or his youth stolen. He was the most isolated and strange little boy Crete had ever known.
They treating you all right at school, Crete said.
Not everybody, but most people do.
You worried about something?
When are they going to take me back?
Who?
The people who run the foster program.
I'm not going to let them do that.
The boy stared at nothing for a long time.
I'm glad my father was killed, and that makes me feel bad.
Crete turned off Main into the motor court, bouncing Homer in the seat.
Your emotions get mixed up in a situation like that, Crete said. See, what you're glad about is he can't hurt you anymore.
I feel dirty.
Your father didn't deserve to have a fine little boy like you.
I feel dirty all the time.
Why?
Because of what they did.
Who are you talking about?
The men who came to the trailer. His friends. I told him about it, but he didn't care. He called me a liar.
Crete pulled the caddy under the oaks and cut the engine and lights.
Those things were not your fault. Your father was an evil man. So were his friends. If I catch up with the men who hurt you, they'll never have a chance to hurt anyone again.
They're going to take me back. They won't let you keep me. There's got to be both a man and woman in the house.
Maybe Miss Carolyn and I will work something out.
I heard you talking to her on the phone. She's moving in with her mother in Lake Charles. Don't pretend.
I won't, Homer. I promise.
Homer walked ahead of him into the cottage and turned on the light. Crete heard a hiss from the shadows and stared into the darkness. A tug was droning up the bayou, its running lights on.
Who's there? Pookie, I got to talk, a voice said.
Crete removed a pin light from his pocket and shone it into the darkness.
You trying to creep my cottage?
I got a flat down the street. I got to hide.
Crete shone the light on Pookie's clothes.
Did you wet your pants?
A guy was following me. Not a guy. The guy.
Makes sense.
Maybe the guy who smoked that cop in St. Mary Parish. He's out of Florida. Nobody knows what he looks like. He's like a cleaner. They said he done just clean. He wipes out everything in the environment. I saw Juju. He said Maximo's missing down by Morgan City.
You need to soak your brain in a bucket of Drano, Pookie. I can't begin to follow the crap coming out of your mouth.
Some might put the glab on Maximo. He takes his lady on a picnic, then she goes for a whiz, and when she comes back, Maximo is gone into thin air.
The lady is the haystack from outer space?
Show some sense of...